Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome, I'm Dr. Deborah.
Hi, I'm Coach Kelly.
Coach Kelly, you look so happy today.
I do.
Are you faking it?
Maybe a little bit.
Have you been sleeping?
Yes, maybe that's it. I literally have gotten probably now a week where my kids have slept through the whole night. So maybe that's it.
That's awesome.
Yes.
Yeah. Because
I don't even want to say it.
Not that you ever didn't look.
Really?
Yeah, like your eyes are brighter. And
it makes sense. Sleep is huge. How are you doing with the sleep?
I've just accepted that I'm a 4.5 to 5 hour a night gal. For as long as that lasts, I'm just trying to make it be as productive as possible.
But you look great. You look the same to me, so it hasn't affected you. Looks-wise, so you're
well,
all good.
Yeah, well, you're so nice. I can't say you just want to get a paycheck because I don't pay
no,
you.
No, exactly. It's from the heart.
So how are you?
So everything's okay. I was thinking on the way over here, like, what happened this week that was kind of crazy and nutty? And no, I mean, I love Halloween. I'm like a Halloween whore. So I'm all about this.
The monsters don't need to dress up because they already are in monster
costumes.
That is
the monster
right?
costume. No, but my big thing is every Halloween, we all dress up as the same thing.
Cute.
So like last year, it all starts with like my older son and he decides kind of what he wants to be. And then we all kind of center around it.
Okay.
So last year he wanted to be a surfer. So we were all like California surfers and I got my dog even like a little Hawaiian shirt.
So cute.
And this year, well, I'll tell you guys afterward because it's a little surprise, but he wanted to be this particular thing. And so, you know, I get all the costumes for it and yeah, so all about it. So we went to a pumpkin patch this weekend and I just love it. I love Halloween. I absolutely love it. So I'm super excited.
Now, so when you have little kids and you have to take them out,
yes.
Then who cans out candy
this
from your
house? This is the problem. I know. So they need to have like Halloween surrogates who like can stay in your home and pass out candy.
Yeah.
You know what? The last couple of years, we've left out a big bowl and just sort of people grab. But it is kind of sad because it's like, I like both aspects of it. I like trick-or-treating with my kids and I also love seeing who comes to the door and that kind of thing. So, yeah, but this year we'll probably, you know, just leave out a bowl and, you know, that run greedy kid's going to grab it all. But, you know, what can you do?
Since I live in a cul-de-sac, we've done the bowl thing too before.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's usually leftover. I mean, they're...
Your neighborhood's nice.
It's amazing. Oh my God. I'm so sad this Halloween because all the little munchkins that were in our cul-de-sac have moved. They've all moved. All my favorite little blonde girls. Yes, there were 7 of them running around. They were so cute from ages like 2 to 10.
And they're gone?
All gone. Yeah.
So you're not even going to buy candy or what?
Oh, no, I'll buy candy. There's other kids and we just don't know them as
right.
well. Yeah.
Yeah.
But we have a cute little, it's like 100 houses in our little cul-de-sac-y area.
So
they all kind of rotate it.
Do you dress up or no?
This year I will be. Yes. Because
you
we're
are?
Actually going to I'm going to be a Seattle Seahawks cheerleader.
Oh my God. You're going to be so adorable. You're going to look so adorable. I could see you being like a cheerleader. Do you know what I mean?
I never made the team.
You didn't?
No, my claim. Claim to fame as a junior high and high schoolers, I was second in everything.
Aww.
I got second for this and second best in this and second best in that. All right, so I'm second.
Right,
I guess it's better than being last.
I didn't get picked for anything, so I'd rather be second. You know,
you were never a cheerleader?
No, I cannot dance. I'm like Elaine from Seinfeld. Like I'm like all off and like offbeat, and I try and like it's really bad. Yeah, my husband, he's like the only Jewish guy I know that can dance. Like he has rhythm. He's good. Like we took a dance class for our wedding, and like the instructor was like using him as the model, and then she'd say to me like, oh, it might be your shoes, like it you know, because I was wearing boots. I'm like, no, I just cannot dance. Like, you're being nice.
You're the 2 left foot.
I do.
Yeah,
I don't even have any feet. Like, that's how bad I am. I'm really, really bad.
But did you do drama?
So I did do drama a little bit, and then I made the lacrosse team because it was like intramural, like it was like anybody could do it. So I made that and loved it and had a great time. But yeah, I tried. Like I was like, do you ever watch The Middle, the show The Middle?
No, okay. I've told you right now I'm obsessed with the Fosters.
Oh, yeah,
and I got
yeah.
you
we'll
obsessed
talk about
with
that.
The Fosters.
But there's a show called The Middle, and there's this the daughter in it. She's like kind of this geeky girl who's like so enthusiastic and like tries so hard. And like that was like me. Like I was like the, you know, the one who was like trying so hard and like, oh, I can do it. And just being like awkward and like, you know, but had like fun spirit. And like, you know, that was me.
Oh my gosh. So, okay. Yeah. All right. So let's do a quick recap of last week's show. Let's give our listeners the phone number. Anybody cares to call in? We have a great guest today. So get your questions ready. You can call us at 323-203-0815. And of course, we love your emails. And last week we had Rosemary O'Connor, the author of A Sober Mom's Guide to Recovery, only for us to show up in studio today with this package from her. She gave us dog toys and so chocolate. Sweet. So sweet.
Such a lovely woman. Well, you know, what I really loved about her was she was just so raw and like vulnerable and kind of really willing to go there and tell her story to help others. And I just really appreciated that.
And the book is really about her story to help other moms. And so, you know, pick up a copy of A Sober Mom's Guide to Recovery, Rosemary O'Connor. Mm-hmm. She was awesome.
Yeah, she was really great.
I mean, okay, so I'm so excited. We have a guest today.
Yes.
Who I got to pick and I'm so excited.
A good pick.
All right, so I'm going to introduce him. And today's guest is David Glass, who is a family law guy, is also a PhD. He's a uniquely qualified family law and probate litigator. He's one of the few select attorneys who is duly trained in law and clinical psychology and who concentrates on child custody litigation, conservatorships, and guardianships. He offers his clients an inside look at understanding of the procedures employed by court-mandated mental health and psychological professionals. Dr. Glass has been certified by the State Bar of California Board of Legal Specialization as a family law specialist, a distinction held by only a small percentage of the family law practitioners statewide. He is rated a perfect 10 on the AVVO.com based on peer and client reviews and has been voted a rising star or super lawyer in Los Angeles. Oh my gosh, this guy's amazing. Anyway, he's a down-to-earth, amazing guy who is gracing us with his presence today in studio on his way afterwards to do an interview.
Yes.
For Extra on Halle Berry. So,
yes,
David, welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're so welcome. So glad to have you here. So give us a little story about, I mean, it is so rare to find a lawyer who is also trained in clinical psychology. So how did that come about?
It came about almost by accident. I was a psych major undergrad. And I had a mentor who said, you need, if you're going to become a psychologist and you want to do academics, you need to have some sort of niche. Because they're graduating too many PhDs, and you need to have something starting out. And so I applied to all psych programs, and my mother saw in the newspaper that a local university was starting a dual degree program where you got your law degree and your PhD in clinical psychology at the same time in 5 years. And I applied to it. I had to take the LSATs. I ran in on a weekend and paid by credit card at the desk.
Oh my
took
God.
The LSATs, got into the program, and went through the 5 years.
Did they give you time off to pee and breathe?
I know. Yeah,
not too much. I took three classes in each. I took three classes at the law school, three classes at the medical school each semester. So it was pretty heavy.
That is intense.
I'm like stressed out just thinking about it, because you know what they say, the first year of like law school, people like break up with their boyfriends and girlfriends. Like it's like the most stressful year ever. So I can't imagine doing both.
Wow. So how long did it take you to get both?
It took me 5 years of coursework, 1 year of internship. And during the internship, I finished my dissertation.
Oh my God.
And then I practiced as a psychologist just for a year and then found my way back to law.
More appealing about law than what was it part of your personality? You just wanted more of that edge, or what was it?
It ended up fitting me better. I'd always loved psychology. That's what I wanted to be. But as I went through the program, I found I liked law more and more.
Yeah.
So I finished up. I insisted on taking a year as a psychologist just to make sure. But the pace was, for me, a little bit too slow. And for my personality, I couldn't be pushy enough. I sort of saw where people should go, wanted to push them there. But that's not how it works, being a therapist.
Yes.
Is that true? Well, nobody told me that.
So as a family law attorney, I can push people, I can shove them, I can tell them what they need to do.
Which is true. It's like advice in a different way, in an appropriate context where you can really kind of give advice and, you know, versus I feel like as a therapist, you sort of have to let them figure it out on their own and, you know, that kind of thing.
You know what's curious about that, though? I've found that over the years, as I've just become more bold and I've become more like, this is the kind of therapist I am. If you're going to come to me, you're going to get feedback.
Yes,
if you don't want feedback, don't come to me. I get a lot more people who come and they're like, here's my story. Here's what's going on. Let's help me figure this out. And so that I get to be much more proactive, which I like a lot too.
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah, and maybe if I'd stuck it out, I could have gotten there too. But as a new therapist, sure, working under someone else, sure, that's just not the way you do it.
And discouraged even to do that, right?
Well, I was just going to say, because I feel like my supervisor even today is like much more like, well, you know, they need to go through their process and that kind of thing. And I think there's appeals to both. I mean, to sort of have them figure it on their own. But oftentimes it's true. I mean, when I'm seeking a therapist, I want that advice because I have my girlfriends I can vent to. Like, I want someone who's really qualified to kind of, you know, set me straight, so to speak. So, yeah, it's
right,
kind of interesting.
It depends a lot on developmental issues, right? I mean, if people have had really damaging childhoods,
yep,
they have to carry so much shame and so much stuff that just to have somebody who could just see them clearly, yeah, and just observe and do a lot of head nodding, mm-hmm, and holding, that's really valuable. But,
right,
you know, for other people who have done that kind of work or didn't have that kind of background, yeah, a lot of people do want more direct feedback. But I have so many questions to ask you about. Today,
great,
we're going to kind of focus on having an amicable divorce, which for some people that sounds like an oxymoron. How,
yes,
can you have amicable and divorce at the same time? But I also want to get into the nitty-gritty of things like parent alienation syndrome and what the courts think about that, mm-hmm, today and all that. So why don't we just start with...
Wait, before we do that, let's give out our number so if people have questions also. Yeah, so if you have questions for David Glass, who's a family law attorney who also specializes in psychology and knows all about that, 323-203-0815.
Okay, so tell us about if a couple's getting divorced and they can figure out the basic structure of their deal, do they still have to go to court?
No, there's no couple in California that has to go to court on any divorce. If a couple can figure out where they want to go and come up with their own plan, they can actually do the paperwork themselves, submit it, and wait for it to come back in the mail with a judge's signature.
Oh, wow. And is a fee associated with that?
It's a minimal. It's a $435 filing fee. But other than that, if you can figure it out yourself.
That's amazing.
You can do it yourselves. The problem is it's not easy to figure out.
Right.
There are a ton of forms and a ton of requirements. And so people who do try to do it themselves often get caught up and have to submit their paperwork two or three times.
Mm. I would also think that a lot of times people may, you know, they just want to get out of their marriage. They're done. They want it to go easy. But they're not really thinking ahead about all the things that could come about, like the holiday schedule with kids,
yes,
and all that. So I would think that a lawyer is actually really helpful in assisting to think of some of those issues that come up later on.
Yeah, and absolutely. Those are and unfortunately, I only get like six or seven of those couples a year. Most of the people who come to me have tried to work it out. They can't.
Really?
They're coming to me for litigation skills. But six or seven times a year, I'll get a couple come to me and they say, we have these ideas. This is the way we want to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I can help them think through the holiday schedule, think through vacation schedule, think about what's going to change once the kids get to high school, and help them develop a program that's going to last them for a good long time.
Absolutely. And what happens when either one gets remarried and has other children in custody and all that stuff? It
right.
can get so
complicated. Wow.
Yeah, Kelly, so you've never been divorced.
No. I hope not.
Thank goodness. And I don't think you ever will. And your parents are together.
Yeah.
Your husband's parents were divorced.
Just got divorced after 40 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Like, I mean, they lived like they were divorced for, you know, a while. But
just got finalized.
Yeah, a few years ago.
Wow.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? I know.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Now, my divorce was, the painful part was getting him to accept that we were getting a divorce, not anything to do with the actual logistics. I mean, he trusted me that I was never going to try to screw him. Like, our daughter was our daughter.
Yeah.
And David, you don't know this, but my daughter was only 7 months when her dad and I split up, and but it took him 5 years to be able to accept that I was really serious. Someday you're going to sign these papers.
Right.
Yeah, but it wasn't like messy in terms of like who gets
what
the daughter when and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So give us some insights into, you know, what is the best way that people can handle getting a divorce? Like, in the ideal world, what would happen?
Right. In the ideal, you know what? It's a lot of it is the way I got divorced. I got divorced about 6 years ago. I'd been married for 14 years.
It's a long time.
The last several years were not particularly happy, but they weren't arguing bitter sort of years.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife and I sat down at the kitchen table one night and said, there's got to be a better way to do this, that both of us could be more happy. And I got out a yellow pad and did what I typically do when a client comes into me, but I did it with our own facts and figures. I sent my my now ex-wife to go see a divorce lawyer just to make sure that it was a fair deal.
Yeah.
I wrote it up because I know how to write it up.
Sure.
And we signed it, and we've lived this way for 6 years. And while we're not friends, we're friendly. And and while at first, the first year, we sort of stuck to the schedule real strictly, since after that, once we calmed down about it, we exchanged weekends and flipped the schedule and just worked things out pretty much by email and text.
Right.
And so it's been a completely amicable divorce, but it was, we came to it with the, with both of us deciding at the same time, we could be doing better. And I really think that divorce can be a second chance or maybe a third chance for some people, but it's a new chance to start off, figure out who you're looking for and how you want to live your life.
Yeah. Absolutely. And there's three variations on a divorce, I understand. There's mediation, collaboration, and litigation.
Right.
Right.
And so mediation is, for most people who have an idea of what they want to do, they go and they hire a mediator, usually an experienced family law attorney or a retired judge.
Okay.
The two, the couple, the husband and the wife, go and hire this person. They meet for a three-hour session and then another three-hour session the next week, and that person leads them through all the right questions. And they eventually get to an agreement, and then they each go off to their own attorney to review the agreement, so they have their own independent counsel. You come to an agreement, and you send it down by mail, and weeks or months later, it comes back with the judge's signature, and you're done.
Okay.
So mediation is the smartest, fastest, most effective way to get divorced. And
and least expensive,
Right. And then going to a mediator for a couple hours is the least expensive way to do it. But on top of that, the psych literature shows that people who figure out early on how to mediate their problems and their issues, then the next time it comes along, they know how to interact in a non-argumentative way. So when things change in 5 years or something happens in 7 years where they have to work together on a child's bar mitzvah or a wedding, they find that they're able to do that because they have this history of figuring things out.
That's nice.
So that's mediation.
Somebody once said to me, just to interrupt, you can't have a better divorce than you had a marriage. Do you see any truth to that? Like if people had a really contentious, tumultuous marriage, that oftentimes their divorce ends up being similar.
You know what? I think that's pretty much true. I haven't thought about it that way, but
so interesting.
But people who do come where they both have the idea that we could do better and we've got to figure this out, those are the right people for mediation. The next step is collaborative divorce. Collaborative is where a couple hires a full team of professionals. So they have maybe some bigger issues. They have a business that they have to divide, or one person has to buy the other person out, or they have some specialty custody issues. And that one person isn't going to be enough. So they each, they hire a team. And the team includes two lawyers. It includes a psychologist to advise on custody issues.
Oh, wow.
It includes an accountant or valuation person to advise on dividing the assets and how to divide businesses. And everyone works together.
Oh, wow.
And so that's for more complex cases, and maybe the people don't get along as well. So they need all these people to help them across the finish line.
Wow. And that still ends up being less expensive than litigation.
Because it's because the two attorneys aren't arguing against each other. They're they're trying from the start to find an answer. Everyone meets together for the most part.
I see.
And so you're working in concentrated 2 and 3 hour sections.
And I would imagine in litigation you have those big teams also, except they're fighting each other as opposed to working together.
Right. And just, and then litigation is the absolute last resort for any case, in California or elsewhere. But if people can't agree, then they have to go to court. And unfortunately, it gets very expensive. Both sides has their expert. Both sides have their attorneys. You're fighting over what information you're going to share. And it's a mini war.
I was going to ask you if you could share sort of one, a couple of your craziest cases and whatever that means to you that was just like that sticks out in your mind that was like, wow.
I guess one of my craziest cases was early on. I started my career in Philadelphia and moved out here 13 years ago. But in Philadelphia, we tried, we had a trial, a huge trial of, of maybe 20 days on every single issue. My client and his then soon to be ex-wife couldn't agree on anything. And we got through the whole trial and we got down to the possessions and the judge was exhausted. And he said, you're going to make a master list of everything you own, couch, planter, plant, pot, pan. and you're going to pick sides. You're going to flip a coin, and you're each going to pick one thing at a time.
Oh, my God.
And so that took 2 days to go through the list.
Yeah.
And they were at that point, you think people would just agree.
Yeah, exactly.
And they couldn't agree. We sat there, two lawyers, two people going through, and if one person picked a pot, the other person picked the pan. So no one ended up with a whole set of anything.
It was just anger. Oh,
isn't that just a byproduct of somebody just not wanting to let go? Like they let their need for vindictiveness get a hold of their pocketbook and they just stop caring.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's crazy. It's
beyond principle. There's no point in it. And it's spending an enormous amount of money to do something that most people should be able to do on their own or with a little bit of help.
So this is sort of interesting because this reminds me. I'm seeing a patient right now, a woman who was married for many years, got a divorce or get in the process of getting a divorce. And she feels like he's mentally ill and had showed me some videos. And he, you know, did not seem like he was in the right frame of mind at all. And they're kind of, you know, figuring out what to do. But the issue is they've got couple kids who are, you know, 11, 12, and they're just so confused and they're thinking, no, my dad's fine. Like, it's just so complicated when you have cases like that. I just can't imagine. Oh, so tough.
Yeah. So is that when psychological evaluation has to come into the mix?
Yeah, typically. Mm-hmm. And that's, a lot of people come to me because their spouse has some sort of mental health issue or they have a background where they were an alcohol or drug abuser and they need extra help getting through the process.
I see.
And maybe I'm a slightly kinder, gentler type of divorce attorney. Mm-hmm. But in those cases, if one party has a serious mental illness and they insist on pushing forward to having 50-50 custody or significant custody, then what we end up doing is going to court and asking for a psychological custody evaluation to be performed.
Those are very expensive, aren't they?
Yeah.
Like $20,000 or
$30,000,
I think.
How much?
$20,000 or $30,000, I've heard.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, my God.
They typically start off with a $15,000 retainer to the psychologist, and that's just to start.
Right. I have a friend who's going through a bitter, bitter divorce. Mm-hmm. She actually ended up cheating on him, and she's making his life miserable because she doesn't like the woman that he's dating and doesn't want the kids to have anything to do with her because I guess they were friends before.
Wow.
So it was like this crazy thing. And he had to get a psychological evaluation. She had to get one. The gal that he's dating had to be part of that. I mean, he's like 30 or 40 grand into it now. Just and he's like the greatest guy. He's the sweetest, greatest guy. And like, I know him really well, that he would never harm his kids or do anything. But she just, which is another question I really want to ask you about when... What did the court see as, let's describe parent alienation syndrome. Do you want to describe that? Yeah, please.
So parental alienation syndrome, the full idea of parental alienation syndrome was developed by some psychologists outside Philadelphia, actually. The idea being that one parent systematically turns the children against the other parent by telling them stories about, it's usually a mom stereotypically turning the children against the dad. And the mom tells the children stories over and over again. Dad never was home for you. Dad abused me. Dad abused you.
Yeah.
And the stories go on from there.
Lies.
Kids, after hearing that over and over and over again, start believing it. Mm-hmm. And then they don't want to have anything to do with the other parent.
Yeah.
And it comes out relatively quickly when you go to a psychological evaluation, because a 5-year-old or a 7-year-old is talking in adult terms about why they don't want to see their dad.
Yeah.
And that's the first tip off that something's going on. The problem is undoing it.
Yes.
Yeah. So what do you do?
And so the full idea of a parental alienation syndrome, the problem is that the research was never peer reviewed. It was never scientifically tested.
Mm-hmm.
And so everyone will agree that there are parental alienating behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a few therapists out there who say they do, you know, reverse parental alienation symptom training, and they don't really have the answers either.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the main answer is to take the children away from the alienator, put them with the other parent for a significant amount of time so that they can find out that this other parent does love them, knows how to care for them, they can see the other side of the story, but it's an awfully rough transition, and oftentimes courts aren't ready to take the children away from mom and give them to dad.
That's what I was curious about, because for a while the courts didn't even acknowledge that parent alienation was an existing phenomenon. Certainly not something that they would say, because of parent alienation syndrome, I am going to direct custody this way. So it still hasn't changed that much.
Right. And so the court understands it now. Mm-hmm. And there are good experts, good forensic psychologists who come in, evaluate the situation, testify to the court and inform the court of what's going on.
Yeah.
The problem was that things swing like a pendulum in the law. Mm-hmm. And so while it was popular at first in the late 80s or early 90s when I first started practicing, mm-hmm. Then when enough people came forward and testified that there wasn't any scientific bedrock under it, it swung completely the other way.
Yeah.
And it hasn't swung back yet. Mm-hmm. So when you have a case where a parent is systematically turning the kids against the other parent, you can't use the words parental alienation. You have to talk about the person not supporting the other parent. You have to talk about the parent gatekeeping, preventing mm-hmm. the other parent mm-hmm. from coming in the gate to see the kids, or not sharing information, or not co-parenting. You have to use all these code words, because once you say parental alienation, most judges perk up and think that you're going down this road that doesn't have a right answer.
Got it. Wow.
I had a client just recently, I probably shared with you, I worked with the daughter, and I could tell, it's exactly what you said, the phrases that she was saying, it was like, it's almost like I could hear the mother talking directly to her, you know? I can't remember, she was only like 8, but she'd be like, you know, I don't know. It's just like the phrases that she used. It's almost like I could just hear the mother talking, and it's just so difficult. But I could already see kind of the brainwashing seeping in,
right?
You know, starting to believe it and starting to turn and say, I don't want to be with my dad anymore. I don't want to be with him. He did this, or you know, he did X, and it's just a rough situation.
Oh, and then when you question them on that, they just say, I don't want to talk about it.
Yes.
It's too upsetting.
Exactly.
So you can't even like confront that. Well, that's not really
right.
True,
exactly.
Actually, you weren't there that day.
Right,
so,
exactly.
You know, it's so tough. The worst of the worst, though, is when, and this does happen, David, you'll speak to this, when a parent claims that the alternate parent was abusive, either sexually or physically. That is just horrifying.
Yes.
Right.
And have you seen some cases like that?
Unfortunately. Yeah. And and I've mainly representing the parent who was accused of being abusive.
Yeah.
And that the court has to step in when you have claims that a child's being hurt by the other parent. You have to cut away the child from that parent for a certain amount of time and have them visit only with supervision while you go through a custody evaluation. And at the end of the 12 weeks or 14 weeks of the evaluation, usually you get to the point that you say there was no abuse.
Yeah.
Nothing ever happened.
Right.
And then you have to reunify the parent who's been away from the other child, who's been away from their child for 3 or 4 months. It eventually works its way out. It's I explain to clients, it's like turning around a battleship. A battleship's so big and it's heading in one direction, it takes a long time to make a U-turn. You'll eventually make it with all the right advocacy, with the right science, with the right experts, but it takes a while.
Do you ever see then in situations like that where then the parent who made the false accusations actually loses custody? Because that's quite a disturbed person
exactly.
to
yeah.
make up
Absolutely.
Shit like that.
And it usually starts off with an analysis of was there any little piece of information that they could have believed, or was it completely made up?
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes the first step is to get that other parent up to 50-50 custody. And then what I've seen in a handful of cases is that then mom makes up a new allegation.
Oh, my God.
That starts the process over. But now the authorities and the judge sort of know what they're about.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunately, the death knell for that one parent who can't stop making these claims. Mm. And then putting the child through physical examinations and psychological evaluations. And that itself is child abuse.
Sure.
It's putting your child through evaluations that they don't need.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
So often it's because, we'll just say a woman, because it is more gender toward women. Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. They just cannot fathom the idea that they're losing part of their identity as the parent. Mm-hmm. And
right.
so they will do anything in desperation to keep their role as the primary parent.
Oh, I see what you're
saying.
When
if, you know, like if the husband is willing to take less custody or willing to do, she'll often stop making those accusations. But
to try to regain
sick.
That power or.
Yeah. Just like, okay, fine. Don't fight me so much. Let me have more of that. And I won't say these things. But I mean, it's crazy.
Crazy.
Just absolutely
crazy. And they show a typical progression. They start off by saying, well, he was never around and he didn't take her or him to school. He didn't.
Uh-huh.
He wasn't involved with the doctors. And the judge says, well, he's going to be involved with the doctors.
Right.
And the next thing is, well, he's a little bit rough when he plays with the kids. And he grabs them and he throws them around. And the judge says, it's regular child play.
Yeah.
And then they keep trying out new and more dangerous accusations until they get some sort of answer
oh
that they
God.
Want.
priests.
If you just tuned in, we have our fabulous guest in studio today, Dr. David Glass, who is a family law and probate litigator as well as a PhD in psychology. So give us a call if you have any questions at 323-203-0815. Again, 323-203-0815. I got a question. How about you?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Mine's pretty basic.
So okay.
My question is the divorce rate still 50-50 pretty much?
It's in California, in Southern California,
yeah.
It's a little bit higher.
Oh, it is.
It's maybe 54%, but nationwide, uh-huh. it's hovering right around 50-50.
Wow.
Which is an amazingly high number.
Yeah.
But it does still say that half of the people are staying together. We just don't know exactly the quality of their relationship.
Yeah, but yeah.
Have you discovered that second marriages tend to be better for people than first marriages? Is there any?
The people I know who are in second marriages, yeah. they all seem to have better second marriages, but the statistics are actually that they're worse.
I was just going to say that's what I've heard too.
It's almost 65% chance of divorce in a second marriage, which informally it tells you that people are either making the same bad decisions about who they think they should be with, or they're marrying the same person with a different face or a different hair color or a different job.
Yeah. What is the statistic, if you even know it, of second marriages that resulted out of an affair? So somebody gets a divorce while they're having an affair and then marries the person they had the affair with.
Yeah, I don't...
Almost always doomed.
Yeah, that's what I would guess. I don't know what the statistic is, but informally that's someone who engages in that behavior is going to most likely engage in that behavior again.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Now, what about classic things like, so many people suffer from depression and anxiety. If a parent is getting treatment for depression and anxiety, can that be used against them in court as long as they're still functioning as a healthy parent?
It's one of the most common misconceptions. What most people come in and they see me about, they say, I'm so scared. My spouse says he or she is going to use this against me. I've been seeing a therapist. Mm. I'm taking an antidepressant, but it's really because of the awfulness of my marriage. And I reassure them over and over again that maybe 10 or 15 years ago, it was a problem.
Okay.
And judges looked at it and said, well, if you're in therapy and maybe you can't take care of the kids. Certainly in Southern California, where everyone has a therapist, most everyone has some sort of medication, it's not as big a deal anymore. And in fact, it's gone the other way. I've seen a lot of judges respond to those sorts of accusations saying, well, she knew she was having problems or he knew he had an issue. He went to go get help. And I view that as a good thing. They're getting themselves straight and right and on solid ground.
Yeah, I'm so happy to hear that.
Me too.
I always felt so sad for people that if you are doing what's right to get treatment and get help, that you'd be punished for that.
Yeah.
Just terrible.
But what does work against you? Like alcohol and drug treatment centers, I imagine. Like, is there anything that, you know?
Yeah, and then
good question.
And interestingly, even having a history of getting drug or alcohol treatment, if you're clean, if you're sober, if you're still going to meetings, those things tend to be not overlooked, but they're minimized by the court.
Mm-hmm.
With the court still reserving jurisdiction that if anything goes wrong, they can step in.
Right.
But it's just poor parenting that counts against poor parents, parents not doing a good job, people who leave kids alone at home and go out, or they're not treating the kids correctly, or they're insisting on having custody time, but they're not actually home. So the kids come home to a nanny, they stay with a nanny, they go to sleep to a nanny, they wake up to a nanny, and they're not actually using the time that the parent fought for. Those are the most common poor parenting things that we see.
I have a question, too, about custody. Do you ever see, like, one parent saying, okay, I want this kid, and you get that kid? Like, do they ever split up the kids? Because I could imagine that could happen.
Almost never. I've had
maybe
once in 19 years, I've heard someone suggest that.
Oh, really?
And I told them that the court just doesn't split up kids, except in the most extreme circumstances.
Right.
And I've never seen those extreme circumstances.
Like if one child is violent toward the other one or something like that.
And those are the examples that people give. I just haven't had that case.
Right. Yeah.
But ordinarily, kids are kept together. That even if the parents split, the kids can find support from each other in moving back and forth between the houses.
That makes sense, yeah.
So I got Kelly hooked on this show called The Fosters. Have you heard of it?
I've heard of it. I haven't seen it.
Oh, you got to watch it. It's a family law guy. It's so intense. It's so dramatic, but it's about this lesbian couple who have a child from her previous marriage, and then they've adopted a set of twins, and then now they have another adoption out of the foster care system, and the younger boy and the older sister, they are being threatened to be split up. It's like this anguish in watching this show. I watched 3 episodes last night. I was like,
did
dying.
You really?
Yes, I can't stop myself. It's an addiction. They're so good. Have you ever seen a situation where you had a couple that was just as contentious as ever, and somewhere in the middle of it, they both have the light that goes off and then just say, this is ridiculous. We're wasting all of our resources.
It actually happens more times than you would think.
Oh, really?
But I'm glad to hear that.
But the realization often comes from just how much money they've spent.
Yeah.
They burn themselves out. They get into a fight. Uh-huh. They get $80,000, $100,000 into it, and they see what that money has gotten them, which is largely nothing.
Yeah.
And then they just realize, we've got to figure this out.
Yeah.
And it's actually a hopeful point. I've had people where I'm the second attorney, they've spent that much money, and I tell them, give it a little bit more time, and if we keep making settlement offers and the other side keeps rejecting them, maybe your spouse will think, well, why aren't we accepting any of these things? Yeah. Why aren't we even talking about any of these settlement offers? Maybe these people who are representing me aren't really interested in what I want or what I need. They're interested in prolonging this. So it happens more times than you would think.
So you may not want to answer this on air, but the behind-the-scenes attorney experience, do you guys go in there brawling in the courtroom and then the two attorneys go out and shoot the shit and have drinks afterwards?
Right.
Yeah, as we see on TV all the time.
Yes, exactly. Like they're fighting head to head. And it's like, oh, come on, let's go get a beer.
Well, you know, to an extent, it does happen that way. And those are the attorneys that I have the most respect for. The people who we go in, we have a job to do. We have a case to advance. Yeah. We have a position that we're trying to win. And we're going to fight as hard as we can in court. But on the outside, and if it comes to agreeing about whether evidence comes in or who's going to go first or who's going to pay for a witness, we can agree to all those things. It's part of a bygone era where, for lack of a better term, being a lawyer was more gentlemanly. And people, when the bar was smaller, they had to fight against each other all the time.
Sure.
And so I think there are too many attorneys who fight on the inside and insist on fighting on the outside. And when you get someone like that, then I just disengage from them. I fight on the inside and don't deal with them on the outside.
Yeah.
I guess it's like a good boxing match, right? I mean, that's what you're in there. You're in there to win the next round and win the next round. But it doesn't mean that you have to go punch each other out on the street.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So interesting. Yeah. This is fascinating.
I know.
Really, really fascinating stuff.
I've got more.
Go for
I've
it. And then I have another question, too.
Okay. The whole, what used to be common law when people would live together, right? And it used to be, I guess, after 7 years, it was common law. And now I understand that there is no common law in California.
There's none, no.
And is there any common law in other states still?
There are about 6 or 7 states
that held
that
on
still
oh, really?
Have common law marriage. Pennsylvania, Louisiana, I just know because I've done the research on those states. But there are a few other states that still have that. If you live together as if your husband and wife, and you mix enough of your assets. You have a joint account. Mm-hmm. You refer to the person as my husband or my wife, even though you haven't had a license, you never had the ceremony, that after a certain amount of time, the court will say that you're to be treated like a husband and wife.
Outside of California.
Right.
Not here
in California at all.
But what about the whole thing if two people share their lives together and they didn't get married, but they hit a wall and they can't do it. And they, you know, did blend a lot of things. Isn't there some sort of just out of human goodness, the person that wants to split up from the relationship to offer some sort of money or some sort of something to help the other person get started? Let's say if they had given up their job or if they had moved for this person.
Sure. Well, there's the goodness of the heart, which unfortunately doesn't happen a lot.
Yeah.
But I have done those, and we call it a separation agreement.
Uh-huh.
People were never married. They lived together. They divided these assets, and this person's going to keep the house, but this person's going to get the bank account, and this person's going to give them a certain amount of money. But that's maybe once a year that I'll get something like that. Then California has palimony. A palimony case is where One person promised the other person, we're never going to get married, but I promise I'll take care of you for the rest of your life.
Okay.
So this this promise has to be witnessed by someone else.
Okay.
And you have to follow through on all those promises up until the point that you break up.
Yeah.
So it's a theoretical case in California, but there are so few winners in that case that it's almost impossible to take that case.
Yeah, because I'm working with this woman who she's so sweet, and she like literally spent 7 years with this guy who's like mega wealthy, like extremely wealthy, and I won't divulge any of her identifying information, but she's in a fairly lower paying job, you know, but they did all these things together, and he basically just said, I want you out, and just after that was it. And I suggested that she get a consultation with an attorney just to see if she was entitled to anything. And she's like, just like you're saying, David, there's some like little slight deviations in what they can do with the law to try to at least get him to sort of step up to the plate and at least be a mensch in some department.
Yeah.
But just brutal, like absolutely brutal, devastating for her too, because he never even told her along the way that he wasn't happy. He just met another woman and he was done. And that was it. You're out.
Right.
Terrible.
And sometimes, oddly enough, you can bring a palimony lawsuit as a wedge, as a force to try and convince the person to do the right thing and say, we're going to bring this lawsuit, but if you do this, then we're going to withdraw it. It just depends on the person and whether you even have the facts to support it.
Right.
Should we do this email or do you have some more?
Oh, sure. Okay. No, go for
it. All right. So we got an email. My wife and I have been together for 15 years, and I recently discovered that she's been having an affair for a year with someone I had once considered a friend. She fessed up and wants to work on the marriage. I don't know if I can ever trust her again, but because we have three children, all under the age of 12, I want to give it a try. My biggest concern is that my wife won't go into any of the details of the affair, and I want to know. This makes me leery of whether we can actually move forward. Dr. D and Coach, can you give me some advice? And Dr. Glass, is there any legal step I should take in case she cheats on me again or I discover some other unacceptable behavior? And if we do separate or divorce, what would you recommend as first steps? Mm. Let's let David,
sure.
You go ahead and answer first.
Okay. Well, I mean, the first step is to get into some sort of therapy, into some sort of couples therapy to work on whatever, to try and discover, is there a reason why this one partner went and had the affair in the first place.
Right.
As to the question of, you know, I want to know what happened, I'm not sure where I stand with that. I typically advise people who come in and they're getting divorced to stop their research, to discharge the PI, and to leave it behind, because finding out exactly what happened and how often it happened and where it happened doesn't buy you anything. It doesn't get you anything positive. And it's a looking back versus looking forward. Mm-hmm. And if I can help people move forward, that's where I want to get them. Mm-hmm. And then the last part in terms of a legal step is to consider filing for divorce, but not pursuing it, to establish that we're going to get divorced if we can't work this out.
Oh, I see.
And having a piece of paper with the court, and you start the process, but then you hold off. You don't go to court. You don't resolve anything so that you're ready to pick up if things don't work out.
Is that because of the financial issues, that it actually closes off any more financial gain for the partner who did the cheating?
You establish a date of separation. The cheating partner, if they're the inferior earner, if they make less money than the other person, it cuts off their flow of money in terms of what becomes community property. It starts the date for potential alimony. So it does a lot of financial things. But I was actually talking more about just putting there's a potential end date.
Yeah.
That I don't know if it's the right way to go into therapy, but having a backstop. If this doesn't work out, this is what we're doing. I think potentially makes it more effective, makes it certainly more real, that if the therapy doesn't work out, are you just going to go home and then continue and sort of be indecisive?
Plan B.
Right. I had a situation similar to this in private practice, but I was going to say that in agreement with you, but I would also add that there is a period, though, that I've seen that for couples to work things out, the person who did the cheating does have to be willing to be really transparent for a little while. And while the gory details of something don't make sense, but knowing who it was with, how long did it last, you know, because the person who was betrayed has so many thoughts in their mind. So when you went to that gas station to go to the market, did you really do that or did you really go? See, like, because there's so many multiple betrayals.
You start to second guess.
If she or he is unwilling to be that transparent and disclosing in that regard for service of building the trust, I usually find that they're doomed.
Right.
Yeah, it's so interesting.
And that sort of disclosure, as I understand it, is from the therapy, is having your phone unlocked all the time.
Yes.
That a partner can look at your phone at any time and has your password.
Yes.
That everything's completely an open book.
And even being tracked, that your whereabouts are tracked, and that lots and check-ins and call-ins to say, I'm here, honey, and I'll be
home.
To
establish that trust again.
Consistency. Yeah. So, yeah. So tough.
It's so tough. I have a question, too, about that. Filing, does it expire at any point? Like, you know, or is it just open until whenever?
The court gives you 2 years to do something with a filing.
Okay.
And then it sends out a letter and says, we've noticed that you haven't done anything with the filing.
Uh-huh.
If you don't do anything with it in 60 days, we're going to terminate it.
I got it. Okay. That makes sense. I wonder if that makes a couple, like, want to work it out less or more if they know that they have that sort of pending. You know what I mean? Because I'm worried that would scare me in the sense that if you got into a fight, it's like, well, I have that file. Let's just end it. I'm so frustrated and mad. Versus if they don't have that filing on the line, it's like, you know, they may be more apt to try to work it out. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And also, if somebody was clever enough to be able to have an affair for a length of time that was unknown to the partner, then I would be suspect if this person wasn't able to manipulate their way through the next year or two to make things seem as if everything is
good.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so then the husband says, okay, I'm feeling good. Uh-huh. Let's keep going. And then boom, it's blindsided. You know, a year after that with another indiscretion. Yeah. So that's just the hardest thing I think on the planet to get over.
Actually,
yes,
this is a great
please.
Question. How many of your cases have to do with infidelity?
Oh, it's a good percentage.
Yeah,
of
I can imagine.
Unfortunately, it's a high percentage of them.
I bet. Yeah.
And that's what makes people angry to start with, and getting over that anger is a lot of part of the litigation at the beginning of the case.
Yes.
And then a percentage of the cases are just they can't agree. Someone wants to pick up and move back to the East Coast with the kids. That you can't agree on. That you need a judge to decide whether it's the right thing or not. But more of the early fighting is based on anger and control.
Mm-hmm. I dated a guy 20 years ago who was in a horrible, contentious divorce and three kids, et cetera. And I saw them fight over the stupidest things on the planet, like a $400 bill. They spent $1,200 in attorneys for this $400 bill. I'm like, stop already. Yeah. Just let it go. Just let this one go. You know, but he just felt so offended that she was accusing him of so many things that weren't true that he just kept fighting and fighting and fighting. And it was a disaster. It was a disaster for everybody. It was a disaster for them.
So hard.
It was a disaster for us because we could never get our relationship off the ground.
Right.
Disaster for the kids. So just, sometimes you want to shake people sometimes and say, even though you make more money, the more people fight.
That's true.
From your heart, though, you don't really want to see people
of course.
Brutalizing
and
each other.
I'd also
and
rather be known as an honest business person and get more referrals in the future than
Absolutely.
From one big whale of a case. But in a similar situation, when I first moved to California, an actor and an actress were getting divorced, and the judge cleared the courtroom because they were talking about custody issues and didn't want people to know the child and what was going on. But then we were all waiting out in the hallway for their case to be done so we could come back into the courtroom. And suddenly the judge brought everyone back in and made the announcement that these two very wealthy people were arguing over piano. We're spending hours arguing over who got to keep the piano. And he said, I'm not closing the courtroom over a piano, and made both of them feel extremely silly.
Right, because it's,
good.
Oh, and then this is my final question. Have you ever worked on a case, almost got to the end, and then the couple decided, you know what, we don't want to get divorced. We want to get back together.
It happened once.
Yeah.
Where people, we went through the whole process. We were about to sign.
Oh.
And then we got the call, we're gonna work on it. We're going to get back together, put it on ice. We're getting back together. They had two kids.
Uh-huh.
And actually it was them coming together, coming to my opposing counsel's office and sitting in the waiting room while we were in the back working out the details. They started talking and remembering old times and then decided to give it another shot.
I wonder if it finally worked out, if they like ended up.
It's 13 years later and I haven't heard from
them.
That's
great.
So
interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I could firsthand say that Dr. David Glass is an awesome family law attorney and an awesome person, and he's been very helpful to me in certain situations, questions that I've had, and I've sent him many of
referrals.
Yes, many referrals that you've done such a great job with. So, from the bottom of my heart, you are an amazing guy. Thank you so much for being on our show. We're out of time.
All
what can we promote for you? your website or anything like that?
Oh, my website is enensteinlaw.com. It's the name of my firm.
Okay.
You can go there. You can find out about my background, find about the news or whichever cases I've been handling. And then if you've got an issue, then the easiest way to reach me is just to email me through the website.
Okay. Yes. So thank you so much for being our guest.
Thanks so much for having
me. Yeah, such important, wonderful
information. Stuff. Really, really fascinating. What a cool job you have. Yeah.
Very exciting. Oh, my gosh, Kelly, it's another week.
I know. It's so, well, do we know who we have next week? Yes. So we definitely have Marlon Young. Mm-hmm. So he's an actor and he has an Audible book. Really interesting. I think it's called, what is it called? Like The Last Dinosaur? I don't have it on me, but really, really interesting about women in the workforce. So it should be really interesting.
Absolutely. And our second guest is Dr. Joseph Strand, the author of Do You Really Get Me? And I think it's about couples and understanding empathy and how we be seen and how we express ourselves and such. And it's going to be our first show where we're having two guests.
Yes.
So we hope that goes well.
Yeah. Hope they get along.
Well,
we'll need David Glass.
Yeah, that's right. So that should be fun. And it's our anniversary month, Kelly, next month.
So cool.
Having done Talk It Out for a full year.
It went so quick.
Yeah. But everybody, we're going to keep going.
Yes, exactly.
So keep sending those emails. Cool. Keep telling us you love us. Keep sending us great
guests. Dark chocolate.
Puppy toys. Cat toys. Always anything. We love it.
Perfect. Sounds good.
So tune in until next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.